Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge today. Glad you could listen. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about healing and the mind. Our guest is a medical doctor who is among those leading the effort to integrate modern scientific medicine, Western style, with branches of healing that involve consciousness and the powers of mind. Larry Dossey is a doctor of internal medicine. He was a battalion surgeon in Vietnam, chief of staff at Medical City Dallas Hospital, and has lectured at the Mayo Clinic, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Cornell, and many other universities and medical schools. Over the past three decades, Dr. Dossey has been an advocate for the role of the mind in health and the place of spirituality in healthcare. He is the author of nine books and many articles, and is executive editor of the peer-reviewed journal Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine. During this hour of Focus 580, we will talk with Dr. Larry Dossey about the ideas in his latest book, Healing Beyond the Body, Medicine and the Infinite Reach of the Mind, recently published by Shambhala Publications. As we talk with Larry Dossey, you're invited into the conversation. Your involvement is very important to us. If you have questions or comments on the topic, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to remember. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, around the Midwest or via the internet, anywhere around the planet. 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Dossey, good morning.
Hi, Jack. It's good to be with you.
Well, very glad to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
And I have to confess that I really try to read the books of the guests that we have on the show, and I've gotten through about half of your book, and the reason is I didn't really want to just blow through it, because it's the kind of book that I'm really enjoying reading and getting a lot out of. So,
thanks very much.
I think there's a lot to draw from, so we'll just scratch the surface, I'm sure, but we'll do the best we can.
Great.
To begin, can you describe how modern Western medicine has dealt with the role of the mind in health and healing?
Not too gracefully. I think it's fair to say that when I was in medical school 30 years ago, that there was considerable doubt about whether or not we should be even talking about the role of the mind. Things were viewed pretty much on automatic. The body was viewed as sort of a fancy mechanical apparatus, and the idea that the consciousness or the mind could play a role was very, very limited three decades ago. We talked a lot about psychosomatic disease, and when we begrudgingly allowed that consciousness could play a role, it was always in a negative sense. No one in those days had any idea that consciousness or the mind could be used in a very positive way. But since then, a lot of changes have happened. We now have the idea of mind-body medicine, which is an acknowledgement that the consciousness can play a role, not just in creating disease, but in also setting the stage for health as well. So I think most people would be familiar with the evidence that, for example, meditation or stress management or relaxation can have a positive attitude or a positive spinoff on health. So that's just one example of how we have gradually come to make a place, I think increasingly so, for a role of consciousness in health. It's no longer a heresy in medicine to talk about the positive aspects of consciousness in health.
Mm-hmm. You write very interestingly about the role of meaning in health and disease, that actually disease means something to somebody, and unless you deal with that, perhaps you can't deal with the disease.
Yeah, I think we ought to do a better job of making a place for meaning. Just as a single example, the meaning of a job or the meaning of one's occupation has a vital role in health. There has been considerable work done on something called the Black Monday syndrome by various cardiologists. And this refers to the fact that more Americans manage to have their first heart attacks on Monday morning around 8 to 9 than any other time. And so this surely is connected with going back to work on Monday mornings. And so various scholars and researchers have looked at what may be going on here. And the picture seems to be that the meaning that people place on Monday morning, 8 to 9, going back to work, the meaning of a job, really is a vital factor in setting us up for a cardiac event. People who hate their job have a higher incidence of sudden death on Monday morning, 8 to 9, than people who adore their occupations. So it's clear in my judgment that the meanings that we take from life events are turned back into our bodies and make a difference physiologically and literally whether we live or die. So I think that we cannot ignore the role of meaning in health.
Mm-hmm. You cite one example of a cancer patient who said that, you know, there was a tremendous benefit that this person derived from having this experience of this disease, that this meant something to their understanding of themselves. Or
that's right. Yeah. Actually, I remember as a young doctor being sort of flipped out by comments like that. And doctors have told me all over the country that they've had similar experiences. People who are going through horrible diseases will sometimes say baffling things. And the cancer patient said to me that this was the most significant event of her life, that her life had been utterly transformed for the better by having cancer and confronting that challenge and everything that it held. And I used to, I remember saying to myself, you know, when faced with difficulties like that, people will resort to anything to put a good spin on it and to rationalize that sort of experience. So I didn't get it as a young doctor, this idea that horrible events could have positive meanings for people and that the meaning that they derive would override the challenge of the negative health event itself. But people commonly say things like that. So gradually I've had to open up in my own understanding of this, as have doctors everywhere, so they tell me.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the way we regard these experiences of health and illness and so forth, what our attitude is about it, what meaning they have for us, affects essentially how healthy we can be or how we deal with, you know, recovering from or healing from something?
Oh, I absolutely believe that. You know, it's quite obvious, I think, in the wake of September 11 that the meaning that people attribute to these events really affects not only their health, but the way we are able to get on with their life. Stress management and grief counseling has become a boom industry since September 11. And all over the country, people are asking how to cope and how to deal with these events. People who simply find a negative meaning in those events sometimes are just practically paralyzed as far as getting on with their lives. Other people are able to find positive meanings in these and can rebound from these events. So I think this idea of the role of meaning playing a vital role in our life is really one that borders on common sense. People who respond to tragic events with fear and trepidation really are setting in motion physiological events in their body, which really can set the stage for illness. For example, stress hormone levels escalate during periods of tension and fear. And if you look at the nationwide, the reported events that drive people to doctors' offices these days, it tends to be stress-related illnesses, such as insomnia, free-floating anxiety, inability to simply cope in the task of daily living. So I think that currently we're just awash in lessons in meaning dating to the terrorist events.
Now, I'm curious about the role of health professionals then in dealing with the meanings that people attach to life events that affect their health. I mean, obviously, psychologists and therapists deal with, you know, the psychological aspects of people's lives. But do you think that we need to expand our definition of the health profession's role in these matters?
Well, exactly. I'm convinced that we don't do a very good job as doctors in dealing with questions of meaning. Doctors are under the gun now. If you look, for example, at the average amount of time that doctors are given to spend with new patients in HMO environments, the national statistics show that the average time is about 7 to 8 minutes. I don't think physicians can do a good job addressing the physical needs of their patients in 7 to 8 minutes, much less get into questions of meaning and so on. So I think that probably, practically speaking, these questions of meaning in people's lives are going to be dealt with more effectively by non-physicians, just because of practical considerations. Doctors don't even make out their own schedules in HMO environments anymore, for the most part. So I think a more effective approach is to consider the role that other healthcare professionals could play in addressing these sorts of issues. For example, the role of nurses and pastoral counselors or hospital chaplains in hospital settings, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, and even just plain old good friends. I'll bet you that at any given moment there's more decent psychotherapy going on in this country that's delivered from friend to friend than by healthcare professionals.
Let's talk about the role of the healer, which is a person that you introduce early in your book as someone who has traditionally played a key role in many cultures, and we seem to have turned our backs on.
Well, let me give an example of how healers function, not just in those ancient societies, such as where shamans played a role, but in contemporary society. One of the hottest medical studies that's floating around the Internet these days was published just last month in September in a major medical journal called the Journal of Reproductive Medicine. And this was a study in healing. It took the form of intercessory prayer, where the healers were using prayer to try to affect other people positively. The study was published out of Columbia Medical School, the Columbia Physicians and Surgeons Hospital. And the study involved people praying for women who were undergoing fertility procedures, something called in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer. This is where the doctors harvest an egg from the ovary of a woman and fertilize it in a test tube and then reintroduce it back into the uterus of the woman and basically keep their fingers crossed that this will eventuate into a successful pregnancy and delivery. So in this study, the doctors asked prayer groups to pray for these women in half of the cases, and the other half of the women were the control group who were not assigned any sort of prayer or distant healing intervention. And when the data were analyzed, the women who were extended the distant healing or the intercessory prayer were twice as likely to have a successful fertilization and pregnancy than the women who were not extended these efforts. There were only 13 chances out of 10,000 that you could explain the results of this study by chance. This really has created a tidal wave of interest in medicine currently. And, you know, doctors are sitting around scratching their heads trying to figure out how this sort of event could happen. But there you have it, here in the guise of a what we call a triple-blind study, published in a major medical journal, evidence of healing that crops up even in modern clinical context. I think this sort of thing goes on all the time. There's a burgeoning body of data suggesting that these distant healing effects happen, and that's actually how I chose the name of my book, Healing Beyond the Body.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is very interesting, and there are other examples of this kind of channeling of healing through either a person or perhaps even inanimate objects that you write about. One is, and some of these perhaps could be considered, I don't know, I mean, they seem like old wives' tales or folklore or something.
Yeah.
The example of eating papers that you write about.
Yeah, the eating papers is one of the more stranger examples of how we may be able to use what I call intermediary objects to serve as conductors, if you will, of their thoughts and their wishes to other people. It dates back, the eating papers date back to oh gosh, antiquity, where people would actually write prayers and healing thoughts on paper and fold them up and give them to other people to eat. So this was putting a physical object between you and someone to convey your own good thoughts and wishes and prayers for that person. There's a long history of this. There are many nuances of the eating papers, but the central idea is that there's an intermediary object that could be impregnated, if so to speak, with your healing thoughts that might convey them to the other person. I actually had an experience of that that sort when my wife and I and some friends were giving a conference at a health spa in Baja California, and during this period of time, I myself came down with a horrible infectious illness. I never knew what it was because we were beyond the reach of modern medicine, and I had a friend of mine who was willing to play this game with me, so I asked him, you know, since we had no access to any modern clinic there, if he would write a prayer for my healing on a piece of paper like the ancients did it. And he was up to the game and actually did that. So I dutifully ate the paper, and you know, it didn't work immediately. But since I lived and survived this horrible illness, I suspected that maybe it did have some effect, if only in my mind. But it was an interesting experience invoking that old ritual. I had fun with it.
Well, it's interesting that some of these things from antiquity come down to us through channels that we don't necessarily perceive or understand or even notice. For example, you know, prescription medicine has indeed writing on it, and some—I mean, that could be, you know, considered a sort of ridiculous example. But you know, you write about Bayer aspirin with this little symbol that Bayer uses.
That's right. The Bayer cross has been those tablets have been compared to just plain tablets with no cross or inscription at all on them, and the Bayer tablets with the inscription, with the symbol, the cross, work better in control studies than a plain tablet does. So these things are still with us, and the symbols don't go away. I think they convey meaning that's unconscious to us, and we bring that meaning into our bodies, and it makes a demonstrated difference. For example, there are more tranquilizers that are blue-colored than any other color, and sleeping pills tend to be pink. And so there's something about blue and pink that affects how we regard these medications, and they make demonstrated differences when you look at how they react in double-blind studies.
That's very interesting. We're talking this morning with Larry Dossey. He's a physician of internal medicine and author of many books about Western medicine and alternative approaches that involve the mind and consciousness. His eight other books include Space, Time and Medicine, Healing Words, and Prayer is Good Medicine. And we're talking about his latest book, recently published, entitled Healing Beyond the Body, Medicine in the Infinite Reach of the Mind. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to change the direction of our conversation because I think that in this particular time, your chapter on war takes on special resonance. And I wanted to ask you to talk a bit about war and some of the thoughts that you and others have had about war being sort of something that is perhaps even a biological urge that we have, something that is almost like a disease condition, and maybe you can just kind of take it from there and you know, share some of the things that you write about.
Well, I have a chapter in the book that is based upon my own experiences as a battalion surgeon on the front lines of Vietnam in the 69-70 time frame. I actually had a very challenging experience when I was coming out of my internship. I volunteered for Vietnam. Well, there was nothing noble in that. I thought simply I'd have a better shot at a better assignment if I volunteered, but it didn't turn out that way. I was given the worst assignment I'd ever heard of in Vietnam for a physician. And I spent a year doing that. And what was absolutely stunning to me is that before I went to Vietnam, I vowed that I would never involve myself unnecessarily in any sort of hazardous duty. And I made this vow to my family and to myself personally. But after I had been in the front lines of Vietnam for as little as 6 weeks, I found all of those resolutions completely going by the wayside. I began to volunteer for hazardous duty and for patrols and so on. It's as if something had flipped in my brain, and I began to see this venture entirely different ways. It was like being seduced by the violence, and this persisted for my tour there. I even volunteered to go to paratroop jump school in Vietnam. I wanted actually to come back and go through officer candidate school so I could return to Vietnam to have my own combat company. So this was a cause for great reflection on my part when I came back. I wondered how in the world could I have done that, because I repudiated every good intention I had before. And I thought, you know, I'm not nuts, I don't think, I'm not insane. If this could happen to me, what is going on here? Is anyone free from the seductions of war? Since that time, I've devoted a good deal of thought and reading to this. There's a huge literature on why humans go to war. I am of a school that says that this is likely to be an innate drive in human beings. But it isn't spread uniformly across the human race. For example, most of the violence, most of the wars are committed and engaged in by young males. Women generally do not participate, at least in the most overt forms of violence, although they support it behind the scenes often. And so this suggests, this gender difference suggests that there's something biologically innate and something that is related to genetics. I happen to think that we're hardwired for this, and that we are in an extraordinarily hazardous period now where we are living through some evolutionary vector that predisposes us for this. It's particularly dangerous now because the toys, the weapons, are more destructive than ever before. I think our biggest shot at getting through this is simply to recognize this inherent physiological predisposition for this. I think if we're aware of the innate drives that push us in this direction, we're more likely to survive this awkward period in evolutionary history. At least that's my hope, Jack.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and then the disease metaphor for war is an interesting one, because it suggests that once someone contracts the disease, there's, you know, perhaps a course of it that, you know, and you know, contagion factor, perhaps.
That's exactly right. And Barbara Ehrenreich, great female essayist and author these days, has used this infection metaphor, I think, to great effect. She does suggest that war can function as a contagion, and it can form spores. And it can survive in the unconscious. The resentment and the hatreds can be driven off the stage of awareness and can erupt at different times in the future, so that no one is essentially immune to this. And I think the infectious metaphor is particularly apt now, particularly since it has literally sprung to life. Never before has our culture been talking about spores and infection as with the current anthrax scares. Mm-hmm. So here you have the metaphor literally coming to life. This is almost like life imitating art or literature.
Well, this is perhaps a rather large question, but you know, if indeed war does behave like a disease, there's an epidemiology of war, so to speak. How does one get beyond? How does one heal that?
Well, I think, first of all, there has to be some sort of awareness that we're predisposed toward these sorts of behaviors, because then one can take more studied action and not react reflexly and fall into the trap of war. The analogy in medicine would be preventive measures. For example, we ought to be thinking ahead during times of peace. You know, disease always crops up. We do not live a disease-free life. And neither would we naturally live a war-free life on a cultural, political scale. So we ought to be thinking ahead of time how we might prevent those periodic outbreaks of war in culture. I don't think we'd do a very good job of that. I think our foreign policy was characterized in the recent past by an attempt to withdraw from our involvement, from the tissue of other nations. We were pulling out of treaties right and left. We seemed to be following a go-it-alone foreign policy with respect to the good advice of our friends and allies. And I don't think that works. I think that's the opposite of preventive medicine, so to speak, against war on a global geopolitical scale. And I think that it has been a sobering lesson since September 11th that we cannot any longer secede from the fabric of nations in those ways. So I think everyone in our culture is now on a learning curve. You know, we're in this together. There are no borders, as we painfully discovered. And so part of the preventive medicine for war is to integrate once again in the community of nations and do what we can to head off and prevent those sorts of events in the future.
Very good. We have a call to talk with. Let me just mention we're a little past our midway point in our conversation with Dr. Larry Dossey, discussing his latest book, Healing Beyond the Body, Medicine and the Infinite Reach of the Mind. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Very interesting topic. Thank you. I'm just curious before I ask my question. I'm not sure war is a biological drive. I'm glad you used the notion of disease, because I think if this is just my own take, and I don't mean to disagree with you, I think if it was an innate tendency in human beings to fight, the army wouldn't have to train people to fight. And I think it's pretty much the peak experience that people experience under adrenaline that leads to, first of all, bonding with your companions, which is very important, I think, in the war experience. It's the same thing that survivors of trauma, you know, of some natural disaster go through. So I'm not sure it's a biological drive. I think it could be more of an addictive cycle involving adrenaline. Because at least, and I respect you for being a combat veteran, thank you very much for serving our country, but just in working with veterans in the mental health field, I know they regard those experiences as almost separate from ordinary human reality, and that's why I don't know if it's just the adrenaline or not. But my question is, what was your path, or what path do you see medicine taking to overcoming the mind-body duality that our society is presented with? From a biological perspective, our mind is obviously encased in our body, and this is something that people just have a really hard time with. I don't know if it goes back to the Hegelian dialectic or if it's a product of Christianity and modern education, but it seems people really want to say the mind and thought and the objects of mind and thought are separate from the body, and then we put down what I call the soul or the dream world or whatever you want to call it, which is a very powerful side, and our culture for some reason denies this. And so I'm very glad you're talking about it, because my feeling is whether there's some mystical connection or whether it's just pure biology is probably not important. As you said, we live in a world with no borders. Everything is connected, and that includes our minds and bodies. And so I'm curious how you perhaps came to breaking down that barrier in your own perceptions. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
That's a great call. I had personal experiences early on in my life as a physician of precognitive dreams. I write about this in the book. Dreaming about clinical events with patients I had not even seen, even to the extent of in the dream seeing the outcome of laboratory tests that had not even been done. These were played out in the future in exotic detail. Those experiences are exceedingly common, by the way, and since I've written about these, physicians all over the country have written me letters sharing similar experiences, so I don't think this is anything unique to me. But the thing that pushed me decisively toward thinking about the relationship between consciousness and the brain and body in a different way than I'd been taught in medical school was something I think that makes all the difference in modern medicine. It's called data. It's called evidence. There now are around 200 studies that show that the thoughts and intentions and wishes and prayers and empathic, compassionate desires of one person for another can change that individual at a distance, even when that individual is unaware those thoughts and wishes and prayers are being extended toward them. Let me emphatically state as unambiguously as I can that we are at a branch point in modern medicine and modern psychiatry and psychology about how we see the relationship between consciousness and the brain and body. We cannot continue to equate consciousness with the brain and make a place for this new data, this evidence. We are going to be forced to enlarge our notions about how consciousness operates in the world. These studies compellingly suggest that consciousness extends beyond the body, that it can have effects out there in the world, and that it's not confined to specific points in space and time, such as the brain and body in the present moment. That's where we are. These studies are being done at first-class universities and research centers around the country. And I would just simply say, hang on to your hat. This is not business as usual in modern medicine and psychology anymore. I know it's hard to put your mind around this when you bump into these claims, such as I'm making, for the first time. But the studies are out there. They're not going to go away, and they're becoming more frequent. So I think this is a terribly exciting time to be exploring the domain of mind and consciousness, because we have data to work with that we simply have not enjoyed for the most part in the 20th century.
Our lines are all full, so I'm going to include some more callers, but just a quick follow-up on that. You write that you believe we have underestimated the boundaries of life and consciousness.
Oh, absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Jack, let me give you an example. The most high-profile study along these lines now going on in the United States is taking place at Duke Medical School, one of the best medical centers in the country, if not the world. And in this study, people who go through Duke with chest pain and who wind up being given a cardiac catheterization study and who undergo angioplasty, the dilating of the coronary arteries because of obstructions in them, are given the option of entering into a study where they may or may not be prayed for. If they wind up being randomized to this prayed-for group, their names are farmed out to various prayer groups around the world. This is all done by email, so that overnight these people are on the receiving end of prayer groups from all over the earth, from many denominations. Make a long story short, the people who receive the prayer have a 50 to 100% fewer side effects from these invasive cardiac procedures than people who are just treated ordinarily. This is a huge difference. This study has been accepted for publication in the American Heart Journal. It's going to be made public any time, and this is just another example of a data point that shows that we cannot continue to regard consciousness in the ways that we have in the past. It reaches out beyond the brain and the body. It's not limited by spatial separation at all. And so to the caller who just phoned in, I would say that this is an example of how we are going to have to open up to radically different ways of thinking about how the mind operates.
Mm-hmm. You use the analogy, and then I'll get on to some more callers, I promise, since we're keeping them waiting. The analogy I think you or somebody else uses is that, you know, the brain, the mind to the brain is, let me back up. The brain is like the mind as a television is to a television program,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
That's right. I think that's a pretty apt analogy. The electronic signal works through the television set. The television set doesn't produce what you see on the screen. And in the same way, I think we could say that consciousness or mind works through the brain. The brain is a kind of receiver of consciousness. But we have said in modern science, particularly in the 20th century, that consciousness produces, the brain produces consciousness. It makes or secretes the mind, if you will. I think that idea is just in deep trouble. It's not going to get us where we need to go because it simply cannot account for the data.
Let's include some more listeners in our conversation. We'll go next to someone in Robinson on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. Dossie.
Hi.
I can't begin to tell you what an honor it is for me just to speak with you. I've been a real fan of yours for a long time.
Thank you.
I'm a retired registered nurse involved in nursing education for many years. And after I retired, I discovered Healing Touch and studied and went on to become a certified practitioner. What is your take on Healing Touch, or are you aware of it?
I am aware of it, and first of all, let me say that I want to tip my hat to the contributions that nurses have made to our understanding of healing throughout, most of the 20th century. I think that we would be farther behind in our understanding of these things if it hadn't been for the fact that nurses have made tremendous contributions, that nurses have simply not struggled with these ideas throughout the past few decades like we physicians have. So I honor that.
I know when I was in nursing school, we certainly looked at the power of touch and the appropriate ways to touch, et cetera. But after having been involved in Healing Touch now for nearly 6 years, I find that not only with the proximity of the body, balancing the energy field, et cetera, has made tremendous contribution to the healing of the patient.
Yes.
And I recognize, as I believe that I've read you do, that all healing is self-healing, that the body heals itself, and we contribute in many different ways through nursing and medicine to that healing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to make one comment about the mind. I have been involved in distance healing now for some time, and you call it prayer or whatever. I have worked with a lady in Singapore and had tremendous results with her recovery from a form of Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So... And we have gotten a group at our church just recently who gather to do distance healing.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to really compliment you on your work in all of these areas. And I'm going right out and buy your new book, Healing Beyond the Body.
Well, I certainly admire your decision. What can I say? Let me respond to your comments about Healing Touch. There are a great number of studies in the general field of healing touch, therapeutic touch, Reiki healing, and so on, which I think suggests very strongly that there are very definite positive effects. I happen to believe that many of the positive effects from healing touch and therapeutic touch and so on have to do with the empathy and the love and the compassion that is being extended from the nurse to the patient. And if you look at the studies in distant healing and intercessory prayer, some of which I've mentioned, I think if you had to pick one factor which is responsible for catalyzing these effects, I think it would be love. It would be concern and compassion and empathy. Unfortunately, we've not emphasized that very much in modern medical education, but these studies, I think, are pointing in that direction once again. So let me just emphasize again my deep gratitude to nurses for the contributions that they have made and continue to make to this field.
We have a couple of the callers. Forgive me, last caller for moving on, but we're running into our last 8 minutes or so. I want to include as many people as we can. I'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, Dr. Darcy.
Yes.
I'm a family practitioner at the University of Illinois, and a great admirer of yours, and read your editorials every time they come out. And I think you've made some truly marvelous points. Number one, back speaking about the written papers, I think it is a very powerful thing that we do when we prescribe for our patients. Not only are we prescribing the name of the drug, but we are prescribing ourselves, our hopes, our expectations, all these unwritten mind, body, and spiritual connections, and that the prescription often can serve as a talisman to give to the patient, such that even if it's not for a written drug, we can write our recommendations to do this, that, or the other thing, and give that piece of paper to the patient.
Well, that's beautifully put. I agree completely.
I had the life-changing circumstance this spring of having acute respiratory failure and being on the ventilator for a week. And I do believe a great deal of my survival and healing came from the intercession of the circle of people around me, my family and close friends who prayed for me in whatever fashion came to heart. And I was recently in the hospital with another pneumonia and was the fortunate recipient of therapeutic touch, which I had known about intellectually for quite a time, but had no preconceived notions experiencing it as a patient. And I must admit, it was a very healing and wonderful experience. And I also am going to go out and get your book.
That's great. Caller, you said you're a family practice physician?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great.
Yes, I am. And I'm planning on sitting for my holistic medicine boards this November in Minneapolis.
Okay.
Well, thanks for your support. I think we're singing the same song here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Duffy.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call. We have another person waiting, and about 5 or 6 minutes left. We'll try to get this person in, and if you'd like to join us real quickly, we'll include at least one more caller, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. This is a listener in Eureka on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Do you recall another prominent author in your field there? I think his name was Herbert or Dr. Herbert or Herbert Brewster or something.
Probably Dr. Herbert Benson.
Benson, yeah.
Right, from Harvard Medical School.
Yes, yes. And, you know, is he still in practice or is he...
Dr. Benson, for about 20, 30 years, has done basic research in mind-body medicine. His,
yes.
His area of expertise is what he calls the relaxation response.
Yes. I'm glad you remembered the name. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, glad we could help with that. Well, we have about 5 minutes left. There's a whole lot of things I wanted to ask you about. But when we talk about the boundary of mind and consciousness, we're talking about healing, certainly distance healing and the power of prayer and so forth. But there's another very interesting angle that you bring out, and that is, and I don't know, I mean, I'm not going to claim to have any particular expertise on this issue, but it does seem to me that some people have the ability to walk in the room and crash computers just without even touching them. Machines break or they work in the case of different people. And I wonder if, you know, what you would say about that.
There is a large body of lore that has developed since we entered the computer age that affirms, Jack, exactly what you just said. I've collected some of these anecdotes, and they are in the book. But there are some electronics firms who actually keep people on the staff because of their recognized ability to enhance the performance of computers. They seem to be naturally therapeutic as far as the machines are concerned. This is just anecdote, and it is extremely difficult to get people in electronics industry to talk about this because people will think them nuts.
Right.
On the other hand, this seems to work the other way, as you imply. There are people who seem to sabotage by their mere presence the function of delicate electronic machinery. So this sort of awareness and acknowledgement is out there. Again, it's hard to get people to come forward about this, but if you try to look at evidence supporting this, I think you can find it at Princeton University, where people are able to influence the output of so-called random event generators, which are very delicate electronic computers, basically. People are able to do this. They can do it from a distance. They can do it in the presence of the computer. But I think this is a demonstrated fact. So the lesson for me is that this is just further evidence that our consciousness extends beyond body. Consciousness seems to envelop not just human beings, but inanimate objects as well. And it raises the question, really, whether these objects are really inanimate or not. Maybe they do have some level of consciousness that we just simply have not appreciated.
Let's try to squeeze in one more caller. We'll go next to someone in Urbana. We have just about 2 minutes left, so we'll have to try to be quick. Good morning.
Is this line one?
Yes, you're on line one.
Yeah, okay. My question is simply, does this prayer for a patient work if the patient has no knowledge that anybody's praying for him? I mean, if he's completely unaware of any of this going on, does it still help? Does it still increase the cure rate?
Good question.
The answer to that is affirmative. These studies, I would remind you, are what we call double or triple blind, which means that the people are not aware that they are being prayed for. And the clincher argument for this is that many of these studies have been done not in people but in animals. People have used rats and mice that have been given surgical incisions, and people can pray for an increase in the healing rate of the surgical wound, and the rats and the mice, compared to the control group, heal quicker. This study has been done by Dr. Bernard Grad at McGill University in Canada. Presumably, the rats and mice are unaware of things like
this stuff in your book.
Yes.
One more. How do you spell your name? Jack should.
I was just thinking about spelling his name.
Should always spell the name.
There you go, Jack.
Very interesting. It's Dossey.
Dossey.
Right.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Well, there's an interesting coincidence. We're going to have to wrap up, unfortunately, since we're out of time, and there's much more we could talk about. But I'll mention the title of the book again, and I'll spell the author's name again: Healing Beyond the Body, Medicine and the Infinite Reach of the Mind, recently published by Shambhala Press. That's Shambhala. Did I pronounce that right?
That's right.
Okay. Right. And the author is Larry Dossey, M.D., last name Dossey. And many other books by Larry Dossey you could look for as well. And sorry to say, we'll have to leave it there. There's a lot more we could talk about, and hopefully we can do that once again with you in the future.
That would be a pleasure.
All right. Larry Dossey, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.